Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Welcome to the Brown Briefly podcast and weekly radio show on the Voice of Vachon, located on beautiful Vachon Island, rising above the waters of Puget Sound between Seattle and Tacoma in the state of Washington. That was the voice of Brian Brown, creator of the Brown Briefly. Brian started the Briefly and brought his high standards of intelligent discussion of current events laced with humor and empathy. Brian's motto was, less is more, more or less, and he always offered more. Our Briefly panel is even briefer today than it normally is. Our avid defender of justice, mariner, cyclist, and top secret engineer Kevin Jones is somewhere up in the waters of northern Puget Sound, I think. The Salish Sea, yeah. And
we don't know where. Is he in the U.S. or is
he's not
going to
let us know. He just said that he's out of range for Zoom. And I'm not seeing Amy, our part-time political, full-time shenanigans coordinator, and the newest and youngest member of the Briefly's, Amy Dreher. Amy may be joining us later, or she may have dropped us a note telling us she wasn't going to be here. I don't remember. I've been flummoxed lately.
I refuse to read email early in the morning. Just sort of like, it's always something like, oh, God, could you do this?
I know. Well, that was the voice of Bruce Holman, a historian, professor, party animal, and Southern Cross aficionado. And our big... Not our big boy pilot, our big board pilot and real life pilot, morning DJ and reformed Texan and Montanan, Truman O'Brien. How are you, Truman?
Good morning. I'm fine. And by golly, we did just get a note from Amy saying that she was going to be on Zoom, and I just turned Zoom off. So I'm gonna scramble around here and see if I can get her up.
Okay.
But you go talk amongst yourselves.
I will talk amongst ourselves. And as a production matter, if and when we get Amy on Zoom, we all need to put our headphones on. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to hear a word she had to say. And she will always offer us her insights, which are really welcome. Joining us today is Kim Kambach, who will be helping us appreciate the importance and the tragedy to a certain degree of Orange Shirt Day, a.k.a. National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, which honors the painful legacy of Indian children boarding schools across the U.S. in the 19th and 20th centuries. That that recollection, that day of recollection was yesterday and is held on September 30th. But before we jump into talking with Kim, let's take a moment to check in with all who are present, and let's get our headphones on.
All right, stand by, folks. I haven't got her on yet. I'm working on it.
All right, I can hear. Oh, my voice sounds better. I sound like I have a voice for radio.
Yes. Always sounds better than in your own head,
oh,
right?
Oh, man, isn't that the truth? How many of us who are producers on this program never listen to their shows because they don't want to
hear their own voices?
Their own voices.
Right. Do I really sound like that?
That's right, exactly. So let's proceed. Bruce, what wonderful or silly things have you been up to this past week?
Well, it's sort of mourning the end of summer, and yet at the same time sort of reveling in the fact that we've got this late sort of summer, early fall, just gorgeous weather right now. I mean, this is sort of like, this is one of the reasons I live in the Pacific Northwest, is for days like these, you know, sort of cool, often overcast in the morning by 11 or 12 o'clock, brilliant sunshine, blue clouds, white puffy. I mean, blue skies. Also, the clouds can be blue at times, but blue skies, puffy white clouds. And it's just a spectacular time of the year here in the Northwest. And apples on the trees are starting to be ripe. The plums are being picked. It's just a great time to be in the Northwest. But it's also sort of typical Northwest. It's time to mourn the Mariners, who did not make it into the playoffs once again. You know, at one point they were 10 games ahead in the division, and then they didn't make the playoffs. So sort of getting reconciled to the Mariners sort of never being what they could be. Which is what Brian Brown always was his focus.
Wasn't it Detroit that had the worst season?
The White Sox.
Oh, yeah. It was the White
Sox. Yeah,
oh.
I think White Sox, 124 losses.
This year. This year, yeah. Oh, my
right.
God.
I think the most losses of any team in baseball ever.
Wow. Not a record you
of course, to. Longer seasons, so more opportunities.
That's right. Sort of stuff. That's right. Truman, I'll hold off on you. You look like you're printing or typing.
It'll just be one
rather
second.
Rapidly. But I'm going to move to Kim. Anything special that you were up to this past week? I mean, obviously, we're going to be talking about Orange Shirt Day, but aside from that, have you been working on your garden, spreading out manure, or doing any of those sort of wonderful things?
Yes, it was the last farmer's market last Saturday, so pressure's kind of off to get something out of the ground and onto the table. So now we're working with turkeys and pigs and getting them where they need to be.
The image of working with turkeys and pigs is actually kind of humor.
Well, it's what I do.
I pigs are smart. I understand turkeys have been known to drown by putting their heads up and look at the rain.
They get a bad rap.
They're really
smart. And remember, Ben Franklin wanted the turkey to be our
national bird.
So
yeah. That's right.
They care a lot about their community.
There's a fellow that raised a group of turkeys. Was in Florida?
In Florida.
Yeah. And he was astounded how smart they are.
And how they protected him from poisonous snakes.
Yeah.
So,
well, that's
something.
Why? I can tell you that they make one heck of a watchdog. I remember I lived in Gig Harbor. There was a neighbor that had a turkey who roamed wild, a big tom. And every time I'd jog by, he'd come after me all fluffed up and making noises. He scared the heck out of me. Are you about ready to tell us what you were up to?
I am. I had a couple of things this week. I got out and about again. How about that? Went on.
That's good. That's good for you.
What night was it? Thursday night, I think. I went to see, I'm going to try and pronounce her name correctly, Efi O'Donovan. It's A-O-I-F-E. It's the Gaelic spelling. Anyway, Efi O'Donovan, fabulous singer. And the coolest thing was that she had these two Swedish guys that were, Hocktail is the name of her group. I had these two Swedish guys, their names are the Vessen, and one played, I don't know what the instrument was. I looked it up and I still don't know what it is.
Hmm.
But it's like a violin, but with keys. Have you ever seen one of those? It's Swedish. It's made in Sweden. Anyway, they were fabulous. I mean, just over the top fabulous.
Not a hurdy-gurdy.
No. Huh? No, it's strung with a bow, and it's got keys on it. I'll look it up for you guys and tell you what it is. But anyway, that was just great fun. And then yesterday, Dre from Gravy won the Voice of Ashon shopping spree.
Spree, right.
And what he did... What a cool thing to do, by the way. He put on a feast at the country store out in the lawn there. It was outdoors. They hit their goal, which is pretty amazing. I heard a number, but I don't want to repeat it. But anyways, pretty amazing. And all the funds went to the food bank.
Yeah.
But is that cool? And by the way, a little feather in the cap of Clay over at Thirstway. Evidently, rather than have them race around and do the shopping spree, he gave them like $2,500 worth of stuff.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Which is pretty darn cool, I think.
That is cool. But yeah. But now we don't have the video of somebody racing around. That's the only downside.
That's true. We don't. But listen, the food was fabulous yesterday. And it was really fun being out, like you said, Bruce, out in the sun, you know, with a blue sky and a little few puffy clouds around. And not just really nice. And it was a great lot of camaraderie amongst the audience. Anyway, great fun.
I love this time of the year as well. It was probably my favorite time of year. You know, the air gets crisp and fresh and whatnot. I did a number of things briefly. Went down to McMinnville, Oregon, and hung out with one of my old friends from high school, my best friend from high school, who I met back in Ohio. He became a doctor and was at the Winslow Clinic for many years up on Bainbridge. He and I just hung out and visited some wineries and went to the Air Museum down there, which is spectacular. It's got the spruce goose there amongst many, many other aeronautic exhibits. I thought it really rivaled the Smithsonian, to tell you the truth. It's pretty spectacular. Then we had a whiskey night. Truman was there.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't even mention that one.
I didn't.
I know you had too many things on the agenda there. We tasted some rare whiskeys that MJ Witt, who's been a guest on our show several times, brought back from Scotland. He had his kilt on, as did John Daly. They were all dressed in their finest tartans. And then I went to the comedy night at Dig. That Richard Moore put on, and that was a kick. There were some very, very funny individuals there. Amanda Knox and her husband did stand-up routines, and she killed it. I mean, she nailed it. Excuse me. But that was a joke that they used about 10 times that night. Very irreverent. All right. No luck yet with Amy. So move on while you are working on that. Today is a significant day, as are all days, and I got my number of days correct here on my notes. It's 30 days until Vashon celebrates Halloween on Main Street. Hopefully everybody has their costumes ready, or at least their... what do you hand out, Kim? Does anybody come by your place on Halloween?
No, it's scary down there.
It is almost haunted, going back in there with a barn and everything. How about you, Bruce?
Well, what's interesting is before the merchants started giving out goodies on Main Street and then closing Main Street, probably in the early 2000s, I can't find the date when they first started it. But living in Ellisport, because there are very few communities where there are houses close together on the island, what was very interesting is Ellisport used to just put on a Halloween sort of spectacular. These folks who lived up on the hill would put big speakers on their deck and play weird, you know, sort of sounds, ghosts and bats and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, there would be just tons of kids walking around the streets of Ellisport because they could actually not have to walk down those long driveways to the scary barns and houses, you know, like Kim was talking about.
That's a perfect example of supply and demand.
Yeah, exactly. And then then the merchants finally, and Vashon finally caught on and said, wait a minute. We can turn this into a spectacular night, which it is.
It is. Now it's rivaled by Stupid Bike Night. I love them both.
The only rival to Halloween is Stupid Bike Night.
That's right. The 35 days until a little event that's coming up on November 5th, the presidential election. Wow. 5 weeks from today.
And tonight, of course, is the vice presidential debate,
correct,
which should be interesting.
It should be. Should be very interesting. And it is 111 days until the inauguration of the 47th president of the United States. What's the feminine of president?
I don't think there's a gender associated
no?
with presidents.
No? Okay. All right. Okay. And then today in history, briefly, in 1880, on October, you know, you get the first of the month, and there's a lot of historical events that occur on any first of the month. So I had to pick and choose between these. John Philip Sousa in 1880 became the new director of the U.S. Marine Corps Band at the age of 26. One of my mother's favorite band leaders. She used to go see John Philip Sousa at Washington Park in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And she'd always love listening to the marches of John Philip Sousa. In 1888, the National Geographic magazine is published for the first time and eventually pays the bills for Bruce Mercer, one of our guests in the last couple of weeks. Those of you who may have missed that or don't know Bruce, you should know that Bruce has illustrated many, many National Geographic articles. Everything is right around, you know, within like 10 years that I picked out here. In 1890, U.S. Congress established Yosemite National Park, I think with the prompting of one John Muir. And in 1891, Leland Stanford Junior University opens its doors.
It's always fascinating. They never put the junior in when they talk about Stanford mm-hmm. University, unless it's a legal matter.
It's only on some emblems and things that are like brass plaques that are in the ground at Stanford. Those of us who went to Berkeley would always call it Stanford Junior. and then finally, and this was the subject of Truman's show just before, just a little while ago, in 1908, Henry Ford introduced the Model T, priced at $825.
All right, now, here's a little bit of trivia for you. Bruce, you being the historian, why was it called the Model T?
Ooh, you got me on that one.
Well, because as they were developing the various models, they started with A, and they went all the way through until they finally got to the car that was the production model, which was the T. And then several years later, they reestablished the Model A as an improvement on the Model T, but they started the sequence over again.
I wondered why they went again. Yeah. Yeah, why they went backwards like that.
That's why.
Whatever happened to the Model X? I guess we had to wait till the Tesla came along.
Probably. Right? Yeah, that was the Tesla. Yeah. Anyway, I thought that was fascinating.
That is.
Oh, and one more bit of trivia. The Model T Ford was the most produced car up until 1972. And if you listen to the show, you can't say, but what replaced it in 1972 is the most produced car.
I missed that.
Anybody know?
I don't.
Offer a guess.
Ford Pinto.
No.
Thank God.
The VW Beetle.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. How about that? All right. So there's the tribute for you today.
That's good. Oh, and one other thing. Today is Jimmy Carter's 100th birthday.
Oh, yeah.
And oftentimes referred to and maligned as the worst president we've ever had. But in my opinion, and the opinion of many of my colleagues in Europe, the best president we've ever had in modern times. All right.
Maybe the best man.
Well, integrity and character count.
That's what I mean.
Not just policies.
There you go.
All right. Let's move on to small talk. I guess we're not having any luck with Amy.
No, I told her that I could. What happened was we changed our login information.
We did, yeah.
And I sent her the old one. I don't have the new one. I'm sorry. I couldn't find it. So she's going to beg off this week.
She gets a vacation.
Yeah.
All right. today, we welcome fellow Vashonite, my friend Kim Kambach. Thanks for being here, Kim.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Yeah, good. Before we get into the subject of Orange Shirt Day, tell us a little bit about yourself. We always like to ask our guests the classic Vashon question of how did you end up on Vashon? What do you do?
I ended up on Vashon because I'd been here 50 years earlier. I grew up in Tacoma. And I left my senior year of high school for rural Oregon. So just this past week, I had my second high school reunion at Wilson, now Silas High School, because I didn't graduate with those guys, but they thought I did because it was the year the high school split into two high schools. So I actually graduated in Klamath Falls, Oregon. But I was born there in Oregon, and my dad worked for Weyerhaeuser, so we ended up here when I was two. And I was baptized at the Firkrest Methodist Church by Chuck Greenwald, who was Mary Matsuda Greenwald's former husband.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
So the Matsuda Greenwald kids, Martha, David, and Raymond, were my Sunday school friends. And the first time I came to Vashon was to pick strawberries after church one Sunday at the Matsuda farm. So that was years and years ago.
Wow. That's a lot of cred. That's a lot of good bona fides.
So you go back, and now you go forward. I was in a bike accident, and the community that I lived in for 25 years, I couldn't remember where I was. I couldn't really speak or remember people's names or words. And with a traumatic brain injury, it takes kind of a long time to recover from it. But when I came to sea level after being in the high desert in Oregon, being at sea level, being with long-term memory store from Tacoma, I remembered the names of the mountains and the rivers and the streams and the places. Mm. And there's O2 saturation here that's much higher than in the desert, and the barometric pressure is more stable. And I was using that long-term piece of memory rather than short-term, which is... So if there's anybody out there that has a traumatic brain injury, I know that there's help around, and I understand how hard it is to lose your confidence in yourself. It's called mental confidence, not competence, but confidence, where every single thing you question, is this real, is it not real, how does this work? And so... it's been a journey.
But. Wow. And that's inspiring. I'm sure that will be helpful to many people to hear that. Let me ask you this. I think I referred to you, as we were talking earlier, as an activist. And you bristled a little bit at that. That's fine. I mean, we all get to call ourselves whatever we want to. I call myself a thousand different things.
Almost. Yeah, I call you a few things.
I know,
things
you
as
do
well,
too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ba-boom. but what do you, you're obviously interested in this issue, the issue of the federal Indian boarding schools. And I use the term because I guess you can correct me on that. Is it appropriate to refer to these as Indian schools?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Good.
It was a part of the removal of Native people from their lands for westward expansion. And, yeah.
Okay. Now you're interested in any number of other civil rights, human rights, justice issues, are you not?
I am.
It just so happens that this is the topic that's timely right now, but I just find it interesting. We talked about this just for a second before we started the show. Is there something about being called, what did I just call you?
I think you called me an activist.
An activist, yes.
And I think sometimes an activist denotes that you're active in a cause and then you expect others to carry the next part of it, the burden of legislation or the justice part. And I want to be kind of the soup to nuts sort of person. Yes, I want to promote causes that I believe we need more justice about, but I don't want to be a person that's just seen for being that voice. I want to continue to be a listener and a learner and an ally with people that are continuing forward.
That makes eminent sense. Truman, I see you raise your hand.
Yeah, I'm fascinated. I'm not really aware of the American version of this taking away the children. I'm more aware of the Canadian version. I know that that was a huge thing in Canada. But so can you tell us more about the American version?
Sure. So the Doctrine of Discovery, which will come up, Bruce will address that later, but the Doctrine of Discovery, 1492, mm-hmm. when Columbus sailed the ocean blue, yeah. that's what we learned, gave dominant cultures that practice Christianity the right to move anywhere, plant a flag if those folks there didn't speak Latin or didn't say that Jesus Christ was their Lord and Savior. If they weren't saved, they became others. And so if you have people going out and colonizing the planet and they're using this other qualification, you get to a place where doing that, you have to remove people that already are there. So we talk about the removal of indigenous people from North America, and really it's 1606. It was the Plymouth Compact talks about removing the people that were there. 1776, President Jefferson talked about removing people.
Right.
And so the reason that we have it in our minds about what happened in Canada, Truth and Reconciliation, right. was they really started quite a long time before we did in about 2013. And they used that ground-penetrating radar to find the number of children's bodies in the unmarked graves. And they began to come forward, and they have had governmental commissions. They right. have their government has looked at where the schools were and what were the policies, which religious organizations had the schools. And so they have done some work in terms of reparations.
Right.
And as you know, the Pope came to Canada right. and talked, and he was accepted by some. The apology is hundreds of years too late.
Yeah.
But it's a beginning so that the story can be told. And I think it's important for me to say that this is not my story to tell, but it's my story to know, and it's my story for others to know the history of what happened so that we can begin to base our policy with all people on historical truths, not historical songs and ditties that we learned as children, but on truth.
Well, that I mean, Bruce, you being a historian, I mean, for me, I mean, it's the old business of, you know, let's not repeat history. And if we have to learn history in order not to repeat it, obviously. And I think this is an excellent way to educate us all.
And I'll address this a question to both you, Kim, and to you, Bruce. Orange Shirt Day is a Canadian holiday, is it? Not holiday, a Canadian
commemoration,
right, a commemoration day. And how long has it been around? Do you know?
2013. Oh, hmm. And then in the U.S., Day of Remembrance. So we are Native National Indian Boarding School Coalition has embraced it as well because they work kind of hand in glove with what started in Canada. Many of those tribes, you know, don't recognize the border, and many of those leaders, tribal leaders, have worked together to try to bring more recognition about this history.
Okay. Is there an effort to make the U.S. version more, quote, official?
Yes, and I think that that's happening through curriculum changes. It's happening through legislation. Deb Haaland has put forth a number of different legislative impetuses to get us to move forward.
And Deb Haaland is Native American, and she's the current Secretary of the Department of Interior, which handles affairs with Native American tribes. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Right. Okay. Well, without getting into too depressing a discussion, what kind of practices occurred to these children that were taken to the boarding schools.
Kim, maybe you can just talk a little bit about what the boarding schools are and what the concept behind them was.
Sure, the concept behind boarding schools was genocide. And it was genocide because you're removing children from their family units, and you're removing children oftentimes saying to people who didn't necessarily read or write English that you have to do this or your tribe won't get this. Mm-hmm. And food was withheld a lot from tribes that had already been moved to reservations, and then food would be withheld if you didn't send your children over here to this boarding school. And what we there were terrible atrocities that happened in boarding schools. It's a sad and horrible past that we have. It's criminal. And we need to just remember that it happened, but we can't get stuck in the trauma as the white dominant society. We can't get stuck in the shame such that that means that we don't talk about it anymore or we ignore it. It's been ignored for 200 years, not written in our history books, and yet Native people know the story, tell the story, and they're still here. So we have over 500 recognized tribes and bands in the U.S., and we have now around that same number of boarding schools that have been identified, because there was a time when we weren't identifying places that were just churches where kids came for day school. But what we know is this was one of the times when church and state held hands together. The government wanted to promote westward expansion. So the way to do that was to get help from churches so they would plant a church ahead of where the Homestead Act was currently being enforced. This church would get this amount of money to remove these families, kids, and the government would pay these churches per diem, basically per kid, to run the church. Well, then, if you've moved your children from one place to another, you follow your children. You want to be with your children. Well, you've opened up swaths of property. And something that most Americans don't know, but Germans certainly know much better than we, is that during the late 20s and early 30s, there were German social scientists that came to the U.S. to study how indigenous people were removed from the land. So when you think about atrocities and Holocaust and how that was all set up, it's not like there was one mastermind. There were many histories that were looked at about how to get people out of where you want, you know, for the resource you want. And it's heartbreaking. I mean, the stories are heartbreaking, and it's such shameful stuff, but we have to keep talking about it.
That's interesting. I mean, there's so much more to this. Many of us have been exposed to this in you know, television and movies to a certain degree. And you see the heartache of the children being taken away, and the fact that they were stripped of their culture and their
language.
especially their language. Excuse me, and they were punished if they tried to revert back to what they were doing. But also this systematic methodology of really affecting the entire culture by putting these schools out ahead, having the parents following, limiting the space, probably went into the creation and then the disregard of treaties. I mean, all intertwined.
So Captain Pratt, who was the person who is quoted as kill the Indian, make the man. Did I say that right?
Kill the Indian, save the child was the mantra that was often used. Yeah.
So he was the person who then saw how boarding schools were kind of evolving, and then he began to institute schools that were technical at the time, they were really workhouses, and they used child labor to make armaments, to make uniforms for the military, all of these things. The very thing that we decry now about sweatshops and so on, we institutionalized it in the heartland of America.
And in Canada, where this, I guess it started, did it precede the schools in the United States?
No, the Jesuit... go ahead, Bruce. The Jesuit schools started along the northern border between the U.S. and Canada, but right. That was for the fur trade. So we have to get people out of here so we can get into these, you know, access more of these rivers that have more of the otters. So they happened at very similar times.
Okay. And you answered, I think, my next question to a certain degree. A majority of these schools, were they run by Jesuits or by...
So if you look at the list, Catholics, Presbyterians, and Methodists, Baptists, I mean, there's hardly a denomination in North America that didn't have a school because it was a moneymaker.
Right.
So... if you want to have a good mission, you know, you set up a school, and you had to follow standards, just like standards have to be followed now in terms of schools, and yeah. Mm. Mm.
It's one of those difficult things in assessing the past. You know, how do you take the standards of today and apply them to the past? And part of the problem was that many of these people running the schools, just like many of the people who were writing the treaties, thought they were doing the right thing. I mean, it's not like they were evil people with an evil intent. It's that they were people who were trying to do something they thought was good from the perspective of their culture, ignoring the culture that they were impacting, and actually doing true evil. It's a difficult thing to sort of get your head around.
It is difficult because there was such a disregard for child development, family development, and they did use just barbaric methods.
It's an age-old problem, is it not,
yeah.
To say the least, the dominant culture versus what some people nowadays refer to as the underrepresented, but that seems like a bit of a misnomer. But the dominant culture would roll over the top of these other minority disadvantaged cultures.
But they weren't disadvantaged at all.
That's a
good
point. They
were very advantaged, and they were very intact, wonderful cultures.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important for us to remember, too, that explorers were risk takers. They were oftentimes people that didn't fit in the society where they came from. And some of the same is true as the people who ran churches in the frontier. They were people who didn't necessarily fit in Boston. So let's send you to, Missouri or something. So I think it's important for us to remember that just about what was given up, what was taken, and yet they survive today. They're here today, and we just need to listen to their stories and listen with open ears, not like in denial.
Mm-hmm. So what is the overall objective then of the Orange Shirt Day or of this particular movement?
I believe that the overall objective is to bring to light what happened as a result of boarding schools, and for us to acknowledge that it's continuing today. Missing and murdered Indigenous women don't get the police notification or recognition that they should. We have the Indian Child Welfare Act, and just on the 26th of September, the Puyallup tribe, you know, commemorated the courtroom in Pierce County that's going to help to be better about how they do that work. But the Indian Child Welfare Act had to be put in place because dominant society was taking children out of the home because the child didn't fit what social service thought was the right thing. That's how I got to Navajo. My former husband worked for the Navajo Nation Justice Department, and he went there to enforce Indian Child Welfare Act, which was passed 1978, and still we have states today that are trying to roll that back.
Yeah, well, one of my senses is it's important to remember what Nelson Mandela did in South Africa with the reconciliation commissions. It's essentially he said that basically we cannot change the past, but we can sit down and recognize that the past occurred and from there move into the future. And that's what this is all about. It's about reconciliation. I mean, we can't change the fact that the boarding schools existed. We can't change the damage that they did at the time. But what we can do is recognize it as a culture, you know, make amends for it, make apologies for it, and move into the future and ensure that we don't do something like that again.
That's kind of the key, is because we do keep repeating these kinds of things in different degrees. When I was with the Attorney General's office, several years ago, but the person who had the office next to me was in child deprivation, you know, what, child welfare. And I remember she used to go, oh, well, you know, this person spanked their kids and they're not very wealthy, so I think we should take that kid away. And I'm going, what? You know? I understand that something you might disagree with some of this conduct, but to take a person's child away from them because of things like that, we keep repeating. But you're right. I think the recollection and understanding of what we've done makes us think today. I wonder if we're still doing that in some ways today. So.
Well, you know, part of this is education, obviously. I mean, to educate the current, you know, population that this occurred. By the way, I just wanted to point out, a few years ago, I got introduced to a wonderful book called The Education of Little Tree. Have any of you read it?
Yes.
Isn't that it strikes to this, I mean.
It does strike to this, and it many tribes have, you know, kind of put it on there, don't read this book.
Oh, really?
Because while it tells a story, Forrest Carter is not, you know,
an indigenous
writer. But.
Well, that's an interesting.
Well, what struck me, though, about the story is that they were trying to take this kid away, and the kid went back to the grandparents and lived with the grandparents and got away from them. So why is that not popular with them?
Because it's not a true story, I think.
Well, no, of course. Yeah.
So, but I think that, like, the Cushman School finally closed down over in Puyallup because so many kids, they had such high truancy rates. Right. They couldn't keep kids there.
Right.
And, yeah, I think that we just have to, let the sadness and the shame sink in that this happened. And then from there, we need to stand firmly with others who are working in Indian child welfare, in missing and murdered Indigenous women, in land back programs, in saving salmon, in climate crisis, all these things. The web comes together, and if we deny one part of it and say that didn't happen, or I never learned that, we won't get to the hard truth. And our curriculums today, very few of them promote the hard truth. Or on Vashon, I honored Dr. Stephanie Spencer and the work she did to get Lucy Duran's picture and the mural up. I honor the state of Washington and the work that they've done with curriculum, honest curriculum. But there's more and more and more out there that we just have to be open to. I taught school on Navajo, and when I taught school, I was in a middle school, and the Arizona State History didn't have anything in it about the Navajo's long walk to Bosque Redondo, where they were there, you know, they were incarcerated, and when they came back, their numbers had been horribly decimated, and There was nothing in the books about that. And so I went to the head teacher and I said, do we really, I mean, what do I do with this? I was a first year teacher there. And my head teacher was Navajo and she said, of course you teach it. And I was like, you know, I was kind of taken aback at how terse she was. And she said, there's a state standard and they have to meet it to move on. And I thought, that's it. That's that thing that's happening that's wrong. It's not standing up. Not that she was wrong. She was absolutely right. Those kids had to move on. But it's not breaking that chain of dishonesty and of, I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, it's difficult because we often use words to lessen the impact. So the Japanese internment, it wasn't an internment. It was an exile and imprisonment. They were in concentration camps. You know, we call them boarding schools. They weren't boarding schools. They were concentration camps. They were re-education camps. And so we use this language that sort of softens the impact, when in reality, I think part of what Kim is trying to do, what Orange Shirt Day is trying to do, what Reconciliation is trying to do, is make the language say what happened. And that's powerful stuff when you get out of this, well, we sent these kids away to a boarding school. When you send them away to a concentration and a work camp and a re-education camp, that's a very different impact on what, and it's more true of what happened.
Mm-hmm. And when 30% of them came home, that is something that's just tragic.
Mm. You mean they were?
I'll get off my soapbox right now.
Oh, no. But you're saying only 30% of them survived?
Correct.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Yeah. And just to bring this home a bit, there were two big schools right nearby here, were there not? There was one, I think, in Federal Way and one down in Puyallup or Tacoma?
Yeah, there were two in the Tacoma area. Cushman was one, and the other one's escaping my name right now.
Saint somebody. Saint somebody,
yeah,
Saint
right,
George's.
Yeah.
I think it was Saint somebody.
And actually the native people of Vashon Island, who were removed in 1853 and sent to a concentration camp on Fox Island and then moved to the Puyallup Reservation. Most of them never returned. The few who did return and the families that were here in the 1920s and 30s into the 1940s and 50s, their children were taken away and sent to the Cushman School. So Rosemary Bridges James in the late 40s and early 50s was taken away from her family, pulled out of the Vashon schools, and sent to the Cushman School. So, you know, it's right here in our own backyard. It's not something that occurs in the Midwest or occurs in Canada. Right. It occurred right here on Vashon Island.
And you have this in the museum to a certain degree, do you not?
We do. We do.
And that reminds me, if people do want to find out more about this, the Orange Shirt Day and Day of Remembrance, et cetera. How might one do that? Obviously, you can go on, you know, the internet and put these terms in there, but do you have any particular...
Sure. The National Indian Boarding School Coalition has a great website that has history and has a list of resources. If you want to hear a Native voices about this, their experience... YouTube has a myriad of, you know, different types of interviews with kids and families. There's a movie that just came out recently called Sugar Cane that's tough to watch, pretty much unedited, just interviews with survivors. But I think that there are enough people in our surrounding area, being on the Swiftwater people's land, that have stories to tell as well. And listening to local stories then makes me understand more about how different federal programs worked. Because one of the things that happened on lands that were given to churches by the U.S. government to establish boarding schools is when the boarding school closed, the lots of those properties reverted back to the federal government, and a lot of those properties are where you see interstate highways, where you see rest areas, where you see all these things that the federal government needed for the public use. And they took properties that didn't belong to them. They took properties where there are remains of children buried, and will those children ever go home? I don't know, because different tribes have different ways of dealing with the departed. But there's so, I mean, once you start scratching on this scab, it gets pretty deep.
Okay. Before we move on, Bruce and Kim, do you have some final things you want to talk about?
Yeah, Kim, maybe he can just mention the November 19th talk at the museum.
There's going to be a talk by Professor Robert Miller, and it's about doctrine of discovery. And this is kind of the basis of colonization throughout the globe. And he'll be talking about what that global impact was, and then really what the impact was here in North America. So it's by Zoom, and it's offered through the Vashon Maury Island Heritage Museum. And go to their website, and you can just sign up, and you'll get the link.
Yeah, Professor Robert Miller is an interesting title. He's the Jonathan and Wendy Rose Professor of Law at the Sandra Day O'Connor School of Law at Arizona State University. And he's a professor, basically, his specialty is Native American law, and he is an enrolled member of the Eastern Shawnee tribe, so he's Native American himself. He's made his field of expertise Native American law and the relationship between the federal government and Native tribes. And so it should be a fascinating talk, and it really gets at that sort of core philosophy that Kim talked about, this doctrine of discovery, that sort of underlies the philosophical basis of assuming that European cultures are superior to any cultures in the world and therefore have the right to move in and take over those cultures, move those cultures out, and sort of, you know, eliminate those cultures, basically. Is that a fair assessment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another resource is Toward Right Relations with Native People, and it's a program that's offered through the Quaker denomination, and you can just sign on at Zoom, and it really gives you a quick two-hour history of what happened, you know. So,
you know, there's a speaking of books again. There's a book called How the Irish Saved Civilization. I don't know if you've read that, but they talk about the monasteries and the writing of the copying of all the documents and making copies of all this. And what I find fascinating about that is that they totally disregard all the Eastern cultures. You know, I mean, how they saved civilization, you know, it should be how they saved Western civilization, you know. But I find that really interesting that there is that same dichotomy.
What's the expression, Bruce, about history? It's determined by those who write it.
Right, it's by the victors.
The winners. The victors, yeah.
The winners write history. And those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it.
To repeat it,
basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Well, thank you, Kim. That was an enlightening discussion, and I really do appreciate you coming by. We have how much time we got left there, Jim?
About 6 minutes.
6 minutes. 6 minutes to resolve the issues, the other issues of the world. And you are welcome to join in on this. We do this rather rapid style.
I just want to add one more thing.
Yes, please do.
It is, I believe, our obligation to learn the true history of the land we're on. And by doing so, I think that we'll find that we feel more connection to this place rather than just being visitors who are passing through in this moment. So I just would encourage people to continue to listen and learn the history of North America and then of the globe.
Yeah, it is amazing how ill-informed many people are, myself included, about the history of this locale and North America.
Yeah, and let me add to that, learn the history of Vashon Island. Not that I don't have a vested interest in that, but, you know, Vashon's a microcosm of the U.S., a microcosm of Western expansion, a microcosm of the whole spread of Western civilization. I mean, you see it all here. I mean, it didn't all happen here, but you see the ramifications, you see the impacts, and you see many of the things that happened all over the world happening here on Vashon. It's a great way to understand that.
No, I completely agree with that. But, you know, I also think about Mexico, for crying out loud. I mean, look at what happened to Mexico, or the whole Central America and Mexico. I mean, you talk about wiping out a culture. I mean, it's amazing. And it happened the same way, exactly the same way that we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. A little bit more violent, I think.
That's the core of what Professor Miller will talk about, is that doctrine of discovery, sort of the philosophical rationalization for Western expansion, particularly of Western culture around the world.
All very good and necessary points to make. Appreciate that. We're lucky to have you, Bruce, and lucky to have you as a guest today, Kim.
Thank you.
Very lucky to have Kim here. And Kim is a board member of the museum and just a valuable sort of asset to sort of keep reminding us of why we're here and why we tell the stories we tell.
Yeah. Moving on to international matters. I don't know if you even know about this, Truman, because you've been on the radio.
I just got notice of it, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The fact that Iran has now sent ballistic missiles over to Israel and is testing, if you will, the Iron Dome. And then, of course, the prediction that Israel will retaliate again with, you know, so there's a potential for great increase in the violence and death in that part of the world, and perhaps getting other countries involved as well. Any thoughts about that aren't self-evident?
I was going to say, boy. Given the topic that we covered today, this is pretty timely, I would think. You know, look at what gets me is that Israel coming into Palestine. I mean, to start with, I mean,
back in the 40s, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, we have it's the same issue that we have.
Well, yeah, it is, and it's interesting because the whole Zionist movement, which emerges in the 1910s and the 1920s out of the Balfour sort of declaration, was really the idea that there was an empty land for people without land. And right. So the idea of relocating the Jewish population of Europe from the diaspora back to the quote-unquote homeland, you know, assumed that there was nobody there, assumed that it wasn't, you know, sort of a vibrant, established culture, and does echo exactly the sort of attitudes of, you know, the doctrine of discovery. Yeah. Vancouver, Wilkes sail into Puget Sound. They don't see fences. They don't see, you know, sort of organized farms, and so they think nobody's here, you know, or the people who are here are nomadic. And they don't really live here. They just move around. And it's just a total misconception of what culture was here.
You know, it's tough for even the most educated students of the Middle East to understand the history of Israel, Palestine, Iraq, Iran, etc. And I know a lot of people that kind of throw up their hands and they go, it's been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's going to go on forever. And it's like, it's almost a hopelessness. And it harkens back to Jimmy Carter, and the Camp David Accords that he mediated and did such an excellent job.
March 26th, 1979. I was a student at GW, and I got pushed along with the crowd into the White House grounds because that was back in the day when they just opened up the gates and you could stand there and watch stuff. So, yeah.
And he used a classic mediation technique. They were, you know, what do each of you want? Well, I want this borderline, you know, Egypt says, and Israel's going, we want this borderline. And he goes, no, what do you really want? And Egypt said, we want security, you know, or we want, you know, our lands. One of them wanted security, one of them wanted, so they came up with the demilitarized zone where, okay, you will put the border here, but you can't put any armament or anything within X number of miles of the border. And they were able to actually come up with a mediated settlement that lasted, well, that particular border lasts to this day. Unfortunately, we've got some different people involved. Mr. Netanyahu is not noted for being the most peaceful individual in the world. So we'll see what happens. What are we looking at time-wise there? We're out of time? Okay. Well, next week, our guest is going to be the outgoing president of the Vashon Mori Community Council, Diane Emerson. She's going to talk about the council, its role, its authority, organization, whatever other hot current topics are going on there.
There are quite a few of those.
Indeed, there are.
Should be an interesting session.
It should be, very much so.